French were residing on the city council for that month used the privilege of the chair to call for a meeting without a request from the government concerned. So I could not get in touch with the government. All communications, telecommunications, everything was broken. The President of the Republic was living in the shelter. The palace was shelled. Everything was disrupted. Mm. Finally, I wrote a letter saying that my general,
No, it's fine. I just wanted to make sure the speed was right.
My mandate authorized me, if need be, to ask for a meeting. And I gave that letter to the President, who agreed not to use it unless his prerogative to call for the Council was challenged. So there was no challenge. Everybody accepted that the President should want to call the City Council, because this was a case which threatened international peace and security in the area. Mm-hmm. Because of its international reputation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was quite healthy.
Mm.
Very well for a few days. A lot of casualties as well.
So was the implementation of that decision effective? Was the shelling stopped? Yeah.
Okay. But of course the Syrians have always claimed that there was a ceasefire, not because Security Council decided so, mm-hmm. that it was reached before the Security Council by a personal contact between the two presidents, which is a lie. President Assad was in Moscow, and our president was in the shelter, and our president was trying all the time to call Assad with no success, requesting for a summit meeting. Assad would not respond, and we had to intervene from New York, and I suspect that Washington called Moscow on the red line and said that this prostitute.
Okay. And then Moscow called
Damascus? Yes, Moscow, they didn't need to call him, he was right there. Assad was in Moscow.
Assad was in Moscow?
Yes.
Okay.
And so he came right back, and President Sarkis went to Damascus right now.
Oh, okay.
They met that very night, 6 hours after the Security Council.
Okay, so then they met?
Yes, and proclaimed ceasefire. So there were two ceasefires.
Mm-hmm.
The ceasefire of the Security Council and the ceasefire of the summit meeting of the two presidents.
I see. Oh, that's a very good clarification.
Because everything was never made clear, and the point became academic.
Yeah.
The fact is that there was a ceasefire.
Yeah, the fact it was a ceasefire. Okay.
And they redeployed with the Syrian forces.
And then in 1983, President Amin Jamil sent you to the UN.
Yes.
What was the nature of that mission?
The nature of that mission, which did not, which turned short, was to try and get secure Security Council, line up Security Council support for the Lebanon to take action to stop Syrian aggression. Acts of Syrian aggression, directly or indirectly.
Mm-hmm.
And we had proofs, we had aerial photographs, we had, so I went there and contacted everybody, and we started proceedings, and then I regret to say this was a very frustrating day. Ambassadors in the 5 hours ordered that this non-stop of Romania to the resolution against the Syrians.
Mm.
They all chatted more or less politely. The most courteous reply was the British. Hassan, why don't you go to Damascus and get things straightened out with the Syrians? I said, thank you. We could, we would have done it. We would come here to get that supervised.
Were you requesting UN troops to be deployed?
We weren't requesting anything. We were requesting, not specifically, we were requesting UN intervention to bring forth a cessation of hostilities,
mm-hmm.
and giving the Secretary General the right to come back to the Council if he wanted, or without coming back to the Council, deploy peacekeeping troops mm-hmm. where it was necessary.
Yeah.
Because the City Council had already given a mandate to the Secretary General, which he did not use. In an earlier resolution, the Council had given the Secretary the right to, if he found the situation deteriorating, to call for the formation of a peacekeeping force and physically troops to negotiate cessation of hostilities, which he didn't do.
He didn't do.
Thought it was impossible.
It would be impossible. Was there a matter of that countries wouldn't contribute the troops?
Well, no, not to contributors, but to contributors as members of the Security Council had their say. Not that they were particularly concerned about the fate of the troops, but they were concerned about the whole issue of what the Security Council could do.
Could do. Okay. There have been many players in events in Lebanon. It's very complicated for an outsider. And we talked about the, to a certain extent, Syria's role. Could you, I know it's hard to explain all of this in one interview, but could you explain to a certain degree the role of the French?
The role of the French. The French wanted to play a role but didn't want to pay the tax. So once, in the very beginning, they were the first contingent to get there. But once they had the first clash with the Palestinians in Tyre, and the colonel was wounded and whatnot, they started planning their pullout. Finally, they didn't want to really pull out completely, so from being the most important contingent, they came down to being concerned with logistics purely, and later with the kitchen and care. Logistics and intendance.
Okay. Did they end up becoming a target?
They probably have been threatened. You know, the political interpretation is more complex than what I have said. In fact, it was if they wanted to defend Lebanon against the Palestinians as well as against the Israelis. Well, fine, they were lucky if they could merely defend this policy vis-a-vis the Israelis. De Gaulle had done that. De Gaulle is a live example of the time. But to defend Lebanon against the Palestinians would impair their chances to follow a pro-Arab policy in other Arab states where the Palestinians were more popular than the Lebanese. And we came up with this conclusion, which is very, very a lesson of wisdom. Never ask the Arabs to choose between the Palestinians and the Lebanese. They will choose the Lebanese. They will choose the Palestinians, whoever is responsible. If you go with a few to an Arab court of justice or an Arab mediator or an Arab assembly of foreign ministers, whatever it is, say, look, we're calling the Palestinians country, etc. They will always intervene on the part of the Palestinians, on behalf of the Palestinians, or never really proclaim the Palestinians guilty. And if you go to the international body and ask them to choose between the Lebanon and the Arab states, then they are necessarily pro-Arab because they have more interests with the Arabs than they have interests with the Lebanese. Lebanon does not weigh sufficiently in the balance. And to make Lebanon weigh in the balance, we had probably to follow a diplomacy which isn't our style, which is brinkmanship.
Brinkmanship?
Yes, maybe create more problems. Not being able to represent an advantage. If we represent a serious international problem, then probably we would be concerned. But we could neither be a major problem. We were a major problem before Resolution 45 or in 1982. Because of Israel and because of the Lebanese. But to represent a major interest for which the world would be concerned against either the Arabs or the Palestinians. Okay.
Now you mentioned that the Arabs would choose the Palestinian case
sure.
over the Lebanese. Why is that?
Oh, because there is a certain secularity to the Palestinian case because probably of solidarity, because the Palestinians are the underdogs, they're persecuted. which is a popular case, but I mean, this is not the case.
Was the French role complicated by its history here in Lebanon?
Yes, but not in the way you would see it.
I mean, as Lebanon being more or less a colony, as a colonial power.
No, there was, the French, you know, never cured from having been a colonizing power. They continued to have a certain affection and love, and yet a love-hate relationship, because they resented the season of them saying, okay, you people, it's out to see what's happening.
What has been the role of Iran in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
Iran.
Iran. Well, in the beginning, Iran was very positive. The first, 50 men who came were an Iranian little detachment of Ansar, a few observers who were on the Golan Heights. They came down to.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when Iran, when Khomeini took over, Iran became the real spearhead of the Islamic movement and resistance, and they took over from the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a phase where they were supporting the Palestinians and the Arab nationalists against the Lebanon as such, and certainly against the Lebanese Christians who were fighting stupidly in the war that should have never waged. And then later, of course, Iran's major chips in the Middle East settlement are in the Lebanon. It's their role behind Hezbollah.
Right, yeah, okay.
They will never tell Hezbollah to call off before getting the facts. What do they call off Hezbollah for? What do you give them? What do they have to do? The mission, negotiations, a safe conduct to the future, a certificate of good behavior. I don't know.
What do they gain in the situation by supporting the Hezbollah? What do they want to gain?
Go and ask them. They're supposed to be in a revolution. They gained tremendous prestige and the nuisance. They've become a player well beyond their borders, whereas the American policy is a policy of containment of Iran. They're containing Iran on its borders, but Iran is present far away on the borders of the Americans' allies.
Mm-hmm.
So the Iranians became, via Hezbollah, the principal enemy.
Yeah. Okay. We've talked to a degree about the external players and supporting nations and different factors.
Yes.
What are the major internal groups?
Yes.
And I know that you've written
quite
a bit about this, and you might just...
I think this takes us beyond.
Because
nothing that I would say in a few minutes
would really work. But you've written several things on this, and could you just, for the record, maybe mention
a few? For
the record,
yes, I would say that I have written a major book, which I consider a major book, called in French, Une guerre pour les autres, namely, Serviette Wars, which was published in France by Jean-Claude Lattès in 1984, and it's out of stock now, and it described the wars and did a very good analysis.
Is it only in French, or has it been
translated?
It has not been translated into English.
It was translated, but not published.
It was translated into English, but not published?
Not published, yes.
Oh.
Well, because by the time I finished the translation, it was overtaken by something else. I mean, it had to be updated, and I didn't have time to update it.
Okay.
Not that I'm lazy, but I mean,
Do you have the manuscript in English, though?
I should have it somewhere. Yes.
Somewhere. All right. So someone might be able to.
Yes.
You
probably,
do
yes.
research with that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
This, because all of this would be used for research. It's important to
sure.
kind of get that.
I wrote a number of lectures. lectures and speeches which are available as well in various universities. And but you were asking me about my journalist career. This is probably a time to conclude on this. A daily newspaper is gives you a style, even if you are trying to be the author of a book. This is not like being a correspondent, and then you come back from where you were and write a book. You're still running a daily show,
yes,
which is a daily newspaper, and in the middle of tremendous events, even if you go to the UN and come back, your main struggle is back at home, and this struggle goes back 50 years behind, as you were asking before. We waged tremendous battles internally in the Lebanon. This was the platform of the National Inquisition in 1962, which succeeded in really running the only white revolution in the Middle East, whereas all the countries in the Middle East were turning in the wake of the Israeli victory in 1967. All the countries were under the military coup d'etats and turning into military governments. So this was the only country where we called for a general strike, and we were I was myself member of the opposition in the House. We were a group of 8 out of 77 members of parliament, and we forced the president to resign and elected one of us, the same parliament where we had a minority, rallied with the public opinion. Before that, I had gone a number of times to jail.
Yes, explain that a little bit.
Well, explain that. I was writing articles that the government thought were a violation of the law because of their violence of criticism. And I went to jail. But I seem to have kept nostalgia, because back in 1972, the president under whom I had served as minister and deputy speaker, deputy prime minister, thought my opposition was becoming too violent and sent me to jail again. But I only stayed 21 days, as I had in the past, so I stayed a number of months. But I mean, in the third world, if you haven't gone to jail, you're not really.
It's a measure of your status.
Well, anyway.
Well, I know that you have an appointment, and
yes,
I think that we should conclude. But thank you so very much.
It was a pleasure, and it was an occasion to reminisce.
Yes, yes.
I must probably write a book in English now that I'm going to be able to retire.
That would be excellent.
But you never retire from such jobs.
Thank you very much.